This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Asra Nomani, is one of the people depicted in the new movie A Mighty Heart. Through her work as a Wall Street Journal reporter, she became friends with journalist Daniel Pearl. He and his wife, Marianne, were staying at Nomani's house in Pakistan when he was kidnapped. Nomani was born in India and grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia, where she now lives. She's Muslim, but she's also a feminist and has advocated for women's equality inside and outside the mosque. She's the author of the memoir, Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She'll be a professor of journalism next semester at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Let's start with a scene from the film A Mighty Heart. Nomani and Marion Pearl are trying to find Danny Pearl, who was kidnapped after setting off for an interview with a radical sheikh. They're talking to a man who knows the contact that helped Danny set up the interview. Asra Nomani is played by Archie Punjabi. Marion Pearl is played by Angelina Jolie.
I'm really sorry about Danny. Have you heard any news?
No. Can you tell us what you know?
Danny wanted to meet Gilani. We went with Arif, and we spoke with Bashir
Gaimon. Who's Arif?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? How did you meet him?
I got his number from a friend of mine.
Okay, so who's the friend?
I can't tell you.
You can't tell us? Why is that? Is that because they paid you for Danny? I mean, like, how much did they pay you for Danny?
I was doing my job helping Danny.
I don't think you understand how serious this is, huh? We need that name to find Danny. Danny is missing. He may be able to help me find him. Okay? I need the name.
I promised him. Mafia, give his name.
Do you understand? Do you understand that maybe you can make the difference of helping Danny or nobody finds him?
Asra Nomani, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what you think of the movie A Mighty Heart.
Well, Terry, it was really hard for me to see. It was a really difficult movie because I felt as if Danny had a cameo in his own murder. He, you know, was the reason why the movie could be made, and yet he didn't come to life on screen. You know, I don't have any fantasies that we're going to get Danny back on the big screen or anything like that, but the friend that I knew in this lifetime wasn't visible up there on the screen, and I just felt like it was such a tragedy.
Now, Daniel and Marianne Pearl were reporting from Pakistan when he was kidnapped, and they had just come to visit you. They were staying at your house when he was kidnapped. So your home became the center of activities for the search to find him. Did you trust the Pakistani police and intelligence agents who were in your home trying to find out what happened to Danny Pearl?
Well, you know, I've always been a journalist all my adult life. I have the same kind of skepticism that any journalist would have of anybody in a position of authority. I didn't fully trust them, but I knew that we needed them. And so there was a cooperation that I've never experienced before, and journalists rarely do with anybody who's in law enforcement. With the intelligence agents, it was particularly difficult because they were a particularly dodgy, nefarious kind of personality. And I felt like, you know, they were playing as many games as helping us. And so that was always like an issue where you felt like you were kind of playing chess.
There's an incredible part of what was happening in your life while Danny Pearl was missing that the movie doesn't touch on at all, which is that while he was missing, you found out that you were pregnant.
And, yeah.
Go ahead.
I didn't know it, but the day that Danny disappeared, I was a week pregnant probably, and I discovered that I was pregnant into the third week of Danny's absence.
Who is the father of your baby, your son?
Yeah, he was a man, a Muslim man that I fell in love with on the banks of the Arabian Sea in Karachi. He was part of the Karachi elite, working in Karachi, living there. And I thought that this was for real. And so the day that Danny disappeared, you know, I found out the truth in terms of the his ability to take the risks that were going to be necessary to stick around.
Was he scared off by the police?
He was. I mean, the Pakistani intelligence, he told me, came to visit him immediately the day that Danny was reported missing. I had put his phone number and his name as my contact when I picked up a account for my mobile phone in Karachi. And so doing their research and investigation into me, they found him, visited him, and asked him to spy on me and what was happening in the house. And he came over then that first day, and he told me, I cannot come around anymore. And I told him, you have a choice. You know, you can stick with us, you can stay with us and help us, or you can leave and run away. And he said, I've made my choice. I must go. And I was mad. I wept quietly, you know, in a corner of my house, and had to wipe away the tears to continue to try to find Danny. And now, so many years later, away from that sense of betrayal and anger, I understand. I mean, I understand that in Pakistan, you can disappear. Your family can suffer for years, and your entire life can be turned upside down if you get too involved in an issue of controversy.
You've said the two defining moments that shaped your relationship with your religion, Islam, were the murder of Daniel Pearl and the birth of your son, Shibli. About the murder of Daniel Pearl, you wrote, the men who plotted the kidnapping of my friend did the five daily prayers that are on the five pillars of my religion, and the men who killed my friend did so in the name of my religion. How did having your son affect your sense of Islam?
You know, when I learned that I was pregnant, I was afraid. I knew that according to the most puritanical and strictest interpretation of Islamic law, I was a criminal because I had had sex without a wedding ring on my finger. I knew that my son could be used as the evidence of my crime. In Pakistan, they had put into place laws called hudud laws, which literally represent, you know, a moral crime. And in Pakistan, it is a crime to have sex out of marriage, not much unlike Western culture of years ago. So what I was confronting at that time and during my pregnancy was this question of whether I would even bring my son into this world. I had to contemplate having an abortion so that I could be a good girl, you know, according to this definition of Islam. It was during my pregnancy when my parents told me very clearly that they loved me and that they loved the life within me, that they guided me to a place of kindness and compassion and love that I think is the best expression of any religion. And then when I came back to West Virginia to have my son, I was told very clearly by a midwife here that I had to prepare for only one thing, and that was my son's delivery. So when I went in to the delivery room, I didn't know how I would respond. And when I was told that his heart rate was dropping and that we had a difficult situation there, all I did was turn to my prayers of protection that I had learned in Islam. I turned to faith, just as I had when I had learned that Danny had been killed. I turned to those same prayers for protection, and I said, Allahu, Allahu, which is an expression of the divine outside and inside. I was trying to bring life to my son, and when he emerged, then I knew what I felt was the best in the expression of divinity in seeing his face, and he brought me new life.
When you returned home to Morgantown, West Virginia, you were really unhappy with the restrictions on women in the local mosque. What were the restrictions?
Well, when I came back from Mecca, I was really excited about the place that I could have in my faith. And so a new mosque opened up. My father had been one of the founders of our mosque in Morgantown, and I was really excited about becoming a participant. I walked up to the front door of our mosque, and an elder stood in front of me and said, "Sister, take the back door." And he was expecting me to take this wooden stairwell on the side of the mosque to the back door and go through a back staircase into a balcony where I would then sit and stare at a wall with the preacher down below in the main hall. And so as women, we were basically told to sit in the back, take the back door, and stay quiet.
And what was your approach to protesting this second-class status?
Well, that first night, I walked through the front door because that's where I was headed, but I didn't go into the main hall. And for 10 days, I sat in the balcony, and it was in the balcony of my mosque in Morgantown that I became a feminist. And then I talked to my family, and so finally, one morning, we went as a family at the dawn prayer time, and we walked into the main hall and prayed. I mean, it was that simple. We simply just took a place behind the men and prayed. And after that, all hell basically broke loose.
Were you threatened?
Yes. That morning we were told very clearly, "Sister, it's better for you upstairs." That night I returned and gang of men surrounded me to tell me to go into the balcony. As I decided to take a public stand about this, I realized that we'd struck a raw nerve in our community that depends on women having second-class status. And death threats came in, and every tactic of intimidation that all people have known and on any issue. And we stopped getting invited to the potluck dinners in our local Muslim community.
So did things finally change at your mosque?
Yes. You know, we had for the first time then women elected to position. Women started coming more regularly. I ended up with my mother most days, just her and me alone in the main hall, because the message was sent loud and clear through the community that good Muslim women did not go into the main hall. And so it was a pretty lonely experience and has continued to be in our local community. But globally, we've had a significant change. All of the major Muslim organizations have come out now defending and protecting the right of women to go into the main halls. In San Francisco, the mosque leaders at one place tore down the wall behind which women were expected to sit. And so what we've had is an incredible shift in our position about where women fit in mosques in our Muslim world.
You're about to start teaching journalism at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies, and you're going to start there something that you're calling the Daniel Pearl Project. What's the project?
Well, for 5 years since we learned that Danny had been killed, I have wanted to know the truth. I mean, everybody who is part of his life, his family, his friends, they recognize that we don't know the full truth. We don't know who the people were that murdered Danny. We don't know why they killed him. We don't know who paid for the plot in which he was kidnapped. And we have to find that truth, I think, if we're going to understand this moment that has become iconoclastic in world history. And so what we're going to do in the Pearl Project is have 20 students, 10 undergraduate and 10 graduate students, working together to try to solve this mystery and also draw a lesson from it. Because at the end of the day, I don't think Danny would want this just to be about him.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has kind of claimed responsibility for masterminding the Danny Pearl kidnap plot. Do you not believe that he was behind it?
Yeah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has confessed to actually being the person who killed Danny. And so we now have Condoleezza Rice, Alberto Gonzalez, President Musharraf, all putting that story out there. And none of the investigators who worked on the search to find Danny and who have tracked his killing have found any convincing evidence to link Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to Danny's murder. It could be true, but at the end of the day, so far, it's a story that's been put out there by politicians to, I think, give us closure. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed may have his own agenda in making this confession. The governments involved may want this just to go away. But at the end of the day, we really don't know whether he was the man who killed Danny.
When you knew Danny Pearl, he's Jewish, but I think he was, you know, kind of non-practicing. Am I right about that?
Well, Danny was definitely Jewish and definitely, you know, like a lot of us, cultural in our practice.
Mm-hmm.
He took me to a synagogue once for Yom Kippur, and then we left early because it wasn't that interesting.
Did you, and you were struggling about whether you wanted to be a Muslim, stay in the faith or leave the faith. Did you talk about religion a lot with him?
We never talked about religion. And I think, you know, that's telling in itself, because we were in a place as journalists where we were passionate about making the world a better place and using journalism as our vehicle for that. But we also spent a lot of time talking about our really pathetic love lives and the fact that, you know, we were both striking out miserably on the dating scene in Washington, D.C. When he met Marianne, he sent me, you know, this list of 100 activities that he planned for this weekend trip with her, and I helped him whittle it down to 10. And that's what we spent our time talking about, and how we were going to basically, you know, get stories past our editors at the Wall Street Journal that we, you know, stories that we really cared about.
Did you ever think that you and he would be in Afghanistan after September 11th and in Pakistan after that?
When September 11th happened, I immediately emailed Danny, and we both knew that we were going to head to Pakistan. I was on book leave from the Wall Street Journal and went over there for Salon magazine. Danny went over there for the Journal. And I think that, you know, that same quality that brought us together as friends, you know, two kids of immigrants who came from very, very different roots, is exactly what brought us both to Pakistan. You know, in our friendship, we belied this concept of the clash of civilizations. And in our reporting, we were so trying to bring some kind of understanding between the Muslim world and the West. Danny had known the Muslim world very well through his reporting. I knew it through my life. And we knew it was much more complicated than the story that people were trying to spin. And so when we both ended up there, it was, I think, just complete natural extension of the people that we are and were, and the kind of work that we wanted to do.
Well, Asra Nomani, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Asra Nomani is a professor of journalism at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Her memoir is called Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam.